Hello and welcome to the Health Report with me, Norman Swan. Today, are you one of those people who, rather than do the 5-2 diet, just goes for a daily fast by skipping breakfast? If so, stay tuned because we'll tell you what happens to your fat cells, and it's definitely not one size fits all. Some troubling news about hormonal contraception last week, which might not be so troubling when you go into the findings. Should you let surgeons loose with a prescription pad when it comes to antibiotics before and after surgery? Some tightening up may be needed according to a recent report. And award-winning Australian research into macular degeneration. Let's start, though, with what happens to your fat cells when you don't eat till midday. A British research group has published the results of a trial comparing the effects on abdominal fat cells in lean and obese people who were either eating breakfast or holding off till midday. The lead author was Javier Gonzalez, who's Associate Professor of Human Physiology at the University of Bath, and he's on the line from Bath. Welcome to the Health Report.
Thank you.
What was known before you did this study?
So there's a lot of observational evidence of breakfast consumption. So we know that people who regularly consume breakfast are typically less heavy than other people, so they tend to have less body fat, but they're also healthier in many other ways, so they're more likely to be physically active and drink less alcohol and so on. So we didn't know whether this was a cause and effect of breakfast consumption.
Or just the nature of the person who has breakfast.
Exactly, or any one of these other confounding factors actually influencing their body weight or their health. So this was one of the first randomized controlled trials to look at specifically energy balance and metabolic health of people when they either skip breakfast or eat breakfast.
So I kind of described the study, but why don't you just talk to a little bit more detail?
Sure. So we took two groups of people, actually. So a group of lean people and then a group of obese people. And each of those were then randomized into two further groups where they either skipped breakfast every day for 6 weeks. So they were asked to not consume anything with energy in. So they couldn't either consume food or drinks containing energy. So that was water only until midday every day for 6 weeks. And then the breakfast group were asked to eat at least 350 calories within 2 hours of waking, and at least 700 calories before 11 a.m. So it was quite a substantial breakfast, but we wanted to, being one of the first studies in this area, to demonstrate a proof of principle.
And was this poached eggs and bacon or toast and muesli? I mean, what was it?
Yeah, so it was self-selected, so they were free to choose what they wished, but we did monitor what they did choose, and it was typically a very high carbohydrate breakfast.
So
it was
more on the
toast and cereal and orange juice.
More on the cornflakes end of the scale, okay.
Yeah, exactly.
And you were monitoring what happened to their fat, so tell us what happened.
Yeah, so before and after that intervention, they all came into the laboratory. All of them were in a fasted state, and we took some fat biopsies where this is a little bit like a liposuction, but on a small scale. So we only take about a gram of fat tissue. People always ask for more to be taken. And then we assess that for various things. So one of the things we looked at was gene expression, which is the activity of genes. So our genes can be switched on and off to different extents. And what we found was that specifically in the lean individuals, their genes that were involved in fat metabolism, so burning fat, they were upregulated or they increased their activity in response to skipping breakfast.
So does that mean they were burning? Does that mean they were burning fat preferentially?
We can't really say they were burning fat because we were only measuring the gene expression, but it does suggest that those pathways in fat metabolism were increased. So yes, it was a suggestion that they were burnt or their fat cells were switching to fat as a fuel.
And what about the obese people?
Interestingly, we didn't see that in obese people, and there were a number of other things that we saw in the lean group that we didn't see in the obese group. So it seems like the obese group were more resistant to the intervention of breakfast versus fasting, and it's, they seem to respond similarly regardless of meal timing.
And they were quite frugal in the way they burned sugar as well.
Absolutely, yes. So that was another difference we saw between the lean and obese groups. So we also exposed these fat cells to insulin, which under normal conditions, that hormone is potent at stimulating those fat cells to take up sugar out of the bloodstream. And in lean individuals, we saw that really robust response. And actually, by regularly consuming breakfast, it increased people's fat cells from lean people, it increased their ability to take up glucose. But in the obese people, they had a lower ability for their fat cells to take up glucose. So they're, we can say their fat cells were resistant to the effects of insulin.
So hold on a second, just to be clear then. So in lean people, when they had breakfast, their metabolism was more efficient and effective. In other words, their insulin was more sensitive than fat people, than obese people.
Yes.
Yeah, and you were also, and reading your paper, the obese people, the response, you interpreted the response as them trying to protect themselves from laying down more fat.
Yeah, so this blunted, or this insulin resistance in the fat cells from obese people, it seemed to be perfectly proportional with the amount of total body fat they had. So it does suggest that because glucose is important in the process of storing fats, it seems like it's a down regulation. Their fat cells are turning off their ability to take up glucose and store fat.
So tell me what the conclusion then is in terms of horse and cart, chicken and egg here with breakfast.
Yeah. Yeah, so what is clear is that by regularly consuming breakfast, people tend to be more physically active, and that's not going to the gym. It's your kind of spontaneous activity that you're not aware of.
So you think it's cause and effect. Breakfast does that to you.
Oh, we can say that from this study. Because it was a randomized controlled trial, people were randomized to consuming breakfast. So we remove all of those other confounding factors. So people were more physically active, but they did eat more too. So the net effects for weight loss isn't clear, but for health parameters, there is a hint that certain aspects of health are improved by breakfast consumption.
Now, there are lots of people who are overweight who try and do their own version of the 5-2 diet, as I said in the introduction, by skipping breakfast and stressing themselves metabolically for 12 hours. What does that say, if anything? What did your study say, if anything, of the sense of doing that if you're overweight rather than lean?
Yeah, so given that there's no major effects on energy balance, I'd suggest that the method that people prefer would be the one to go for. So if you're someone who does like to consume breakfast, then you can be aware that the benefits of that are you are likely to be more physically active throughout that day. If you'd like to try some form of intermittent fasting, then just be aware that your physical activity levels might drop a little bit. And while you might get some of the benefits of increased fat metabolism, be aware that physical activity might drop. And of course, you can counteract that. You're aware of that, and you can perhaps time your physical activity or your gym sessions in line.
Well, Javier, thank you very much indeed. I'm not sure whether I'll have breakfast tomorrow morning or not. I suppose it depends whether I go to the gym.
yeah, sounds good.
Javier Gonzalez.
Great, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Javier Gonzalez is Associate Professor of Human Physiology at the University of Bath. You're listening to The Health Report here on RN, ABC News and CBC Radio across Canada. I'm Norman Swan. Last week, the New England Journal of Medicine published a huge study on the risks of breast cancer in women using hormonal contraception, with one or both of the female hormones. So we're talking about the oral contraceptive, which is a combination of estrogen and a progestin, or an intrauterine device or an implant containing a progestin by itself. The findings from following 1.8 million Danish women for 11 years showed a 20% increase in risk in current or recent users. Professor David Hunter from the University of Oxford wrote the editorial that went with the paper in the New England Journal and is on the line from the UK. Welcome back to the Health Report, David.
Norman, hello.
Have you had your breakfast yet? I mean,
I haven't yet, but I'm planning on doing so.
Okay, well, that's obviously going to increase your activity and make you much more metabolically active. Let's get on to the pill. I'd have thought by now we know everything there is to know about the pill. Thanks to the University of Oxford, we've got data on hundreds and hundreds of thousands of women followed through in the 60s and 70s and their risks. What more can we find out?
So you're right. So in a sense, this is old news, but the twist here is that the formulations of specific progestins used in the pill and the doses of those hormones used in the pill have changed over time. And so the big study you referred to was mainly looking at women who used the pill in the 60s and 70s and getting into the 80s. But this is the first really big study that looks at the type of pills that women have been using in the 90s and into this century.
Now, did those studies that you did in Oxford all those years ago show an increased risk of breast cancer?
They did, and the increase was essentially the same as the increase in this paper, about a 20% increase in risk, but only while women are currently using the pill. The risk rapidly declines once women stop using the pill.
That was from that study. It's slightly different in this one, which we'll come to in a moment. Now, in those days, they thought it was the estrogen that was the problem because the estrogen drives breast tissue to proliferate. And since then, they've thought that progesterone might be the problem from the studies of postmenopausal women where estrogen-only hormone replacement didn't cause breast cancer, but with progesterone, it did.
Correct. And a number of new progestins have been tried in different formulations. I think the hope was that we would just sort of stumble into a type of progestin that wasn't associated with increased risk or might even reduce risk. But this study shows that we haven't got there yet.
So this study showed then that 20% risk, whether you're having the pill or a progestin-only implant or IUD.
Correct.
What did, now, women's age had an influence here because I seem to see from your editorial that it was mostly in women aged 40 where the risk was. Is that right?
Well, the 20% increase in risk appeared to apply across all age groups, but the fact is that the background incidence of breast cancer increases quite rapidly over the age group that women tend to be using oral contraceptives. So fortunately, breast cancer is still a very rare disease in this age group, but it's really rare in women in their 20s. And unfortunately, the incidence starts to climb as women get into their late 30s and their 40s. And so that 20% extra risk predicts more cases, excess cases occurring in women in their late 30s and 40s. It might be that women in their late 30s and 40s should be advised to discuss with their doctor other non-hormonal forms of contraception.
Now, the 20% sounds a lot. It's called the relative risk, as you were just describing over the background, the added risk. What's the absolute risk, which is much more meaningful to an individual woman deciding whether or not she should take the pill? What's her personal risk, in a sense?
So again, breast cancer is uncommon in these age groups. Across the entire age group of women using the pill in the study, for every 8,000 users for 1 year, there was about one extra case of breast cancer.
So it's not.
But among women under 35, that was only one for 50,000 users. So that really shows that most of the extra cases were occurring in women in their late 30s and 40s.
And what about the risk after stopping the pill? Because you were talking about current users or recent users.
So this study did put up a flag. First of all, it showed what had previously been shown, that risk increases with duration of use. So women who were using for more than 10 years had a higher risk than women who were using only for a year or two. There was also a hint in the data that the risk persisted for longer than we'd thought in the past. But it was really only a hint. This is the first study to show this. Even a very big study like this, there's a lot of different statistical comparisons being made. So I think we don't want to make too much of that. And the risk clearly does drop fairly rapidly. Certainly within a few years it starts to drop after a woman stops using oral contraceptives.
Now, the Oxford study years ago showed that the pill also protects against some cancers, ovarian cancer, endometrial cancer, colorectal cancer. Was that measured in this study? I know it wasn't reported in it, but do we know what the figures are for that protection with the new preparations? Is it likely to be the same?
It is likely to be the same protections we've seen in other studies, and we have got some evidence for these new types of oral contraceptives that validate that the protection that was seen for the older types also applies for the newer types. And so there's a substantial reduced risk of ovarian cancer, obviously a very nasty but often highly fatal cancer, reduced risk of endometrial cancer, and very probably a reduced risk of colorectal cancer. So many studies that have tried to look at the risks and benefits have concluded that across a woman's lifespan, the pill might actually protect against cancers. The trouble is the protection comes a decade or two after using the pill, whereas the increased risk of breast cancer applies pretty much only while a woman is using the pill.
More immediately. And so in summary then, 20% higher risk, higher when you get older, But really, the absolute risk is incredibly low under the age of 35 and does return to normal. So just finally, David, because your core interest is in the genetics of breast cancer, if you've got breast cancer running in your family, is there an increased risk from the pill?
That we don't know, because a study like this doesn't have the genetic side of things, and most of the studies of genetics don't have information on lifestyle and environment. My guess is that the risk would apply the same. Again, it would be a little bit magnified, perhaps, because women are at higher background risk if they have a substantial family history of breast cancer. But that's only a guess at this point. I don't think we know enough to factor this into genetic counseling for women who've got a very bad family history of breast cancer.
David, I'll let you get off to your breakfast.
Great, thank you. I'm looking forward to it. Sausage and eggs.
Oh, I wouldn't lead to that. David Hunter, who's Richard Dahl Professor of Epidemiology and Medicine at the University of Oxford. Barely a week goes by without panicked headlines about resistance to antibiotics and trying to control their inappropriate use. One very appropriate and common use of antibiotics in hospitals is to prevent wound and other infections after surgery, called surgical prophylaxis. In fact, according to a recent survey, it's the commonest reason for antibiotic prescribing in acute care facilities. But a pilot study for the Surgical National Antimicrobial Prescribing Survey, or SNAPS, has found a high level of inappropriate prescribing in surgical prophylaxis. Tricia Peel is a senior research fellow at Monash University and leads the hospital stream of the NHMRC's National Centre for Antimicrobial Stewardship. And Tricia is in our Melbourne studio. Welcome to the Health Report.
Thank you, Norman.
So what defines surgical appropriate surgical prophylaxis?
So we give, as you said, surgical prophylaxis in patients undergoing surgery when there's a high risk of infection from the procedure, or when there is sort of significant ramifications for patients who get an infection. So, for example, people who need a prosthetic joint, if they get an infection, obviously they have severe consequences. Not all surgeries, though, need prophylaxis, and we consider it appropriate when it's according to current guidelines, which are based on evidence.
So if you're having colorectal surgery, yes. If you're having cataract, probably not.
Well, so other procedures like skin cancer removals and things, you don't necessarily need prophylaxis.
Now, there's other things. So the timing is right. So people who've had surgery might not know they've had antibiotic prophylaxis, because it's usually the anaesthetist that squirts it in around the time of the operation.
Yes, that's correct. Often the patient might be asleep or about to be put to sleep, so they're not always aware of what's going on and what they've been given at the time.
So, but what you're measuring in terms of appropriateness is, has it been given around the time of the surgery so that you're loaded up with the antibiotic there and then, and it lasts long enough to go through the procedure?
Yes, that's correct. So when we look at it, we look at a number of factors. So did they get the right drug? Did it get given in the right dose and by the right route? And then was it given for the right duration after the surgery? So it's not just one measure, it's a number of things that make up appropriateness.
So when you did this, this is a pilot survey to actually work with the College of Surgeons to get it right. What did you find?
So we looked at a number of different aspects. We looked at the antibiotics given at the time of the procedure, but also looked at what patients were getting after the surgery, and tried to try and understand some of the factors that influence prescribing and perhaps influence inappropriate prescribing. So when we looked at the procedural antimicrobial, so that's what the patient gets when they're being put off to sleep, we found that about 45% of the antimicrobials prescribed weren't in keeping with recommended guidelines, which is...
So they were getting they weren't getting the best drug?
It was a number of things. There were a number of reasons. Actually, the most common reason for it being inappropriate was actually it was given at the wrong time. So we know that giving it within a certain time period is associated with a reduced risk of infection, but they were being given at times that were outside that window.
So it might have been too early, then it wore off during the operation.
Exactly, or given too late, so it wasn't in the tissue at a good level in order to prevent infection.
And then what happened afterwards?
So we then also looked at what antibiotics were given after the surgery, and for most surgeries, patients actually don't require any antibiotics. And when we had a look of the procedures where you had a antimicrobial prescribed, about 60% were actually not in keeping with guidelines. So that was for around about 1,200 surgical episodes.
So in other words, they were getting it when they didn't need it.
Exactly, yes.
So what can be done about this? Well, I mean, I suppose the first question to ask is you don't really know yet how generalizable it is because it's a pilot survey.
No, that's important to note. There's a number of things that we need to take into account when we look at this data. The first thing was it's a voluntary participation, so hospitals elected to participate in the survey. So there's a potential selection bias.
You might be seeing
bias.
The good side of things.
Well, we might, or the converse might be true. We might be seeing the bad side of things. The other thing is these hospitals decided how to apply the survey. So, for example, they may have targeted the surgical group where they knew they were experiencing problems. So you have to take that into account when you interpret the data.
So something's got to be done about it, but you don't quite know yet. But what should, just finally, before we leave you, what do consumers need to know about this? Because it's something that happens under the radar in a sense. Is this a question that you should be asking of your surgeon and anaesthetist about surgical prophylaxis?
I think that's exactly what we're planning to do. I think it's the thing to know about surgical prescribing and surgical prophylaxis. It's not just one person who makes a decision. It's a complex decision made by the surgeon, the anaesthetist, and there are other influences such as the patient and also the hospital administration and et cetera. So we need to be able to understand what are the underlying reasons for why surgeons or anaesthetists are prescribing in this way and try to work out systems to improve that practice. But from a consumer's perspective, I guess they should be aware that when you undergo surgery, this always entails a potential risk and that we give prophylaxis in only certain groups. And so
just ask the question.
Yeah, just ask the question and be aware.
Tricia, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Tricia Peel is a senior research fellow at Monash University and leads the hospital stream of the NHMRC's National Centre for Antimicrobial Stewardship. The Florey Medal is arguably Australia's leading prize for medical research. And last week, this year's Florey was awarded to Professor Elizabeth Rokotse, founding director of the Department of Molecular Ophthalmology at the Lions Eye Institute at the University of WA. Elizabeth has made many discoveries and advances around the use of stem cells and gene therapy to treat or prevent various causes of lost vision, including macular degeneration, the commonest form of age-related blindness. Professor Rokotse is in our Perth studio. Welcome, Elizabeth, and congratulations.
Oh, thank you, Norman.
Let's start with what's called wet macular degeneration, which is where, at the moment, there is a treatment where you get injected to the back of the eye to stop the blood vessels proliferating. And you've developed what's hoped to be a new form of treatment for this, just involving gene therapy. Tell us how it works.
Well, here, In our case, we are using modified viruses which can deliver a biofactory into the back of the eye. And basically, this biofactory is producing the medication over years to come. So in this case, we can replace the monthly injections into the eye with a single one. And the treatment can last for long, long periods of time.
So you get a virus and you essentially infect the back of the eye, but the virus is like a taxi which takes, and the passenger Absolute. Is this genetically modified tissue which then produces the drug effectively or the effect.
Yeah, so the taxi or the delivery vehicle is a modified virus. So imagine virus what we are using, adeno-associated virus, and it has been, which is a harmless virus, so you can inject, all of us have been infected at a point of time in our life with adeno-associated virus. We modified this virus, taken out most of the information which is required for multiplication and certain things what viruses do. We took that information out and put in a code which which is a gene for something which can inhibit neovascularization in the eye or blood vessel formation.
And the gene's in the virus, or the gene gets moved into the tissue at the back of the eye?
The gene gets into the virus. Now, the virus is then injected into the back of the eye.
I understand, but once it's in the back of the eye, does it stay in the virus or does it go into the tissue in the retina?
the virus enters into the tissue, into the cells in the retina.
And do you think this is going to be a, because you haven't yet, it's got to be developed for use in the clinic, is this a once-off or a once-a-year injection? What do you think?
We have run a clinical trial, actually, on 40 patients.
Oh, really?
And yeah, and we found that, first of all, more patients responded to this treatment positively than to the traditional treatment. And the patients who responded well were all treated with this gene therapy. And these patients required one injection for 3 years, over 3 years. Sometimes, you know,
that's saving, $2,000 or $3,000 a month, plus having to get somebody injecting your eye.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so you've done a deal with a developer to actually get this out there into the clinic further from beyond your trial.
Yes, it has been licensed to a startup company in San Francisco.
Is it going to be affordable? Because the drugs are only just barely affordable in the back of the eye.
Look, this would be the first new style drug which would be used for the treatment of a common disease. So how much is going to cost, we really don't know. But at the moment, I think that it is still in the clinical trial phase. So
now the other form of age-related macular degeneration is called dry form, which is there's no treatment at the moment. And I think you've been looking at the use of stem cells to actually replace the receptors at the back of the eye here using stem cells. How are you going with that?
Oh, look, that was a long time ago. And since then, many, many other groups have tried. And I think the results are mixed. So at the moment, the treatment of dry age-related macular degeneration is we don't have a treatment. I think that's the short answer.
And this gene therapy and using the virus, you've got this right, and many people have not got it right, using it in all sorts of other areas. What other uses, now that you've got the technology kind of right, do you see for this technology beyond the eye?
I think one of the important point in our case was that we are using a gene which is present in the naturally in the normal eye. So basically, we do not have any problems with immune rejection. Now, if with aging, you know, the biological balance in the eye is disturbed. So it in case of the eye, you know, you just get the factor which is inducing new vessel formation in surplus. And what we are neutralizing now with a factor, which is naturally occurring factor, which is delivered with this biofactory. Now, there are other diseases where the disease is caused by an imbalance, you know, in certain organs. So I think that this concept of a biofactory, we should be able to use it for other diseases. Obviously, there are, for example, one disease is hemophilia, and I just read it last week that, you know, they have made huge progress in that field.
For hemophilia B.
Yeah.
Well, good luck and congratulations again, Elizabeth Rakoczy.
Okay, thank you.
Professor Elizabeth Rakoczy of the University of Western Australia and the Lions Eye Institute. This has been The Health Report. I'm Norman Swan. I hope you can join us next week.